Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And today we're talking with Julie Camp. She's the author of the book, My Bad to My Best, How Individuals and Companies Can Differentiate Themselves in the Age of Mediocrity. Julie, welcome to the show.
Good morning, David. Nice to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, no, we appreciate it. We appreciate you coming on. Hey, you know, I got to tell you, it's an interesting book, From My Bad to My Best, How Individuals and Companies Can Differentiate Themselves in the Age of Mediocrity. Tell me a little bit about, you know, let's start at the beginning, as they all say. Why would you write this book?
I got to tell you, it wasn't to become a best-selling author. It was really more out of a frustration about the way that people treat one another, both personally and professionally, how people sit around waiting for responses to emails and phone messages. And I just felt like it was we're becoming a dumbed-down society, and I really wanted to get the message out and, have the conversation, at least start the discussion. You'd hear it from people. How this one hasn't done this, and I can't believe I sent this and I haven't heard a response, or, you know, this person quit in my organization, they were so terrific and they were just mistreated, and, this doctor left a scalpel and this person, I knew somebody who went in for an operation, they took out the wrong part of the body. And I mean, this is just, you know, you see CEOs of cruise ships, where they're stuck in the middle of the ocean and, you know, doesn't seem to really faze anybody. And I don't know, I was brought up differently, and I just felt that in the culture that I've created in my organization, I felt I can't be that different and special, that we need to just be more respectful and civil and cognizant of one another's things that are important to one another. And so that's really why I wrote the book.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Civility is an interesting term, and we could certainly say that over the years it seems to become less and less important. And I don't mean in the sense that it's not important. It just seems to be becoming less and less. If you look at social media, if you look at, you know, the day-to-day things that are even said on TV, the day-to-day things that are happening between organizations, the inability to respond like you necessarily would from the HR side. I mean, these are very important changes that are happening in the socioeconomic stage here that we're at.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And when you think about, you think about people and you look at the demographics of what our landscape looks like today, and I'm sure the audience pretty much knows the graphs and charts that shows that we've got, you know, baby boomers that were retiring, 10,000 people a day, and we've got a much smaller generation behind that, and then we've got this big generation called the millennials that are following, and everybody communicates differently, and everybody, but that doesn't mean that people can't be civil and respectful to one another. I mean, I don't know if you know this number, and I was shocked by it myself, but $300 billion a year lost to acts of incivility in companies, meaning people resign. They don't, they sit and don't do their work properly because they're unhappy. Now, I'm not saying that people don't have their own, reasons for being unhappy or that maybe they shouldn't be in those jobs, but there's so many things that go on in corporations today, and the HR community, I think, is aware of some of these things, but there's just so much that they, as one or a group of people, can do. I can tell you that my turnover in my own organization is extremely low, and I think the reason for that is because we've really created an environment where everybody is equally respected, doesn't matter what your level is. And a lot of this comes from the top down, too, right? I mean, so it's however the tone is set from the top. But if you look at some of the companies out there that are able to really attract great talent or an employer of choice, those are some of the things that, when you think about differentiation, are so important. For companies today and for anybody today. There's a lot of competition. Social media has told us that, there's a lot of competition out there in just about anything you're doing. If you need a different doctor because you don't like the way your doctor handles things, you'll find somebody else. If you don't like your contractor, you'll find somebody else. If you don't like your head of marketing, you'll find somebody else. And I think that, you know, we all have to be cognizant of that and very aware of how we talk to one another and how we treat one another. It's really important. If you look at the election that just passed, I mean, I can't think of a more uncivil, disrespectful, horrendous environment that created a lot of stress for a lot of people. And it wasn't really necessary, you know. It's like when you kind of have a disagreement with your spouse. You know, fight the issue, don't fight the person. And that's really it. In companies, everybody has a right to expect performance. But, you know, you can't really fight the person. You have to really discuss the issue. And I think that really kind of centralizes the theme of everything.
Well, you know, to your point, you do now have social media, which allows people to, unfortunately, in some cases, just say something based on emotion, not necessarily on fact. And part of the challenge on social media is, and I tell people all the time, is you can type it. Why don't you delete it and wait like a few hours before you actually send it? Because, you know, that emotional shift that happens when you're in the heat of the battle, the heat of the moment, the heat of the issue is not necessarily the truth. And then it's very hard to take it back once it's gone.
I completely agree with you 100%. And I would tell you that I read every email that I send out at least multiple times to make sure, because people receive things through social media, through email, through text, through posting. They receive things differently. It just manifests itself in your brain differently than a face-to-face conversation or a phone conversation. You can't hear the intonation in someone's voice. You can't hear if so many times you see things on, you know, one of the social media outlets and you think, wow, that was really harsh. And then if you speak to the person, because you might know them, say, oh, I was just kidding. But you wouldn't hear that unless you actually spoke to them. So we have really become, we're like a parallel society in the sense that, you know, we're not speaking to one another anymore. We're not having conversations with one another anymore. We're having text and dialogue. So you just don't know how someone on the other end is going to receive that. And if you send out an email thinking that, you know, oh, this is perfectly acceptable and, you know, there's nothing else, but you just don't know how the person reads it. And that's where a lot of some of the confusion comes in. You know, freedom of speech is a very important thing. I think the social media outlets have allowed things that, you know, have been very divisive. I mean, Twitter, you know, we have a lot of Twitter followers. We, you know, make sure that everything we're posting is extremely respectful. You know, we're headed in a different direction, and it's hard for a lot of people to get their hands around.
Well, I think part of this is certainly the fact that communication has changed. You brought up the fact that we're, you know, tweeting and we're texting, we're doing that and talking less. And as you know, written communication is one of the worst forms of communication because it's allowed interpretation. There's no way to understand emotion being put into the actual text itself. And even this big shift to go to emojis and everything, which supposedly has a little more emotion to it, it's not that clear. It's not that cut and dry. It's not that simple. And so when you're in the workplace and you're dealing with, you know, HR and business owners who are trying to communicate to clients and employees, it really, really becomes a much bigger challenge and issue, which somebody can turn into, you know, let's be honest, can leave the employment, can file a lawsuit, can do all these things based upon interpretation of what is said versus an actual meaning.
That's exactly right. And I always say, you know, I was brought up in a home where my parents said, if you can't say something nice, kind of keep your mouth shut. You know, a lot of the people in the, you know, just general environment just don't. They just post whatever they want. They say whatever they want. Everything's acceptable today. I just don't think that everybody handles it the same way. And so, you know, especially when you're talking about being a business owner and creating, you know, a culture where people are feeling free to innovate, free to express their, you know, themselves in a way that they know is respectful, but they have a seat at the table, that's okay, you know, and not everybody, you know, we have staff meetings every week and we'll do articles, and sometimes people bring articles to the table and they may interpret it differently than what some of the maybe the more experienced people in the organization might think, but nobody's wrong. They're just expressing their opinion, but in a very nice and respectful way, and here's what my opinion is and doesn't make them right or wrong. We may not agree with everything that's brought to the fore, but that's how you create the greatest amounts of innovation in an organization, as long as there are some parameters. I mean, if you think about not only lawsuits, but how much money is lost to people who are just sitting in jobs where they're not really doing a great job because they're unhappy with their environment, and so they're not producing, and they're not, you know, ultimately, you know, allowing the company to grow and flourish. And those people, some of that could be due to things that somebody said to them in the organization, or they didn't like the way they said something to them. And, you know, we just always, so that's where the whole thing with the book came out. And I'll give you another example. It has nothing to do with, you know, work, but went to a doctor one day and made the first appointment in the morning and ended up waiting 45 minutes. And when I said to the doctor, I said, why is it that I have the first appointment and I'm waiting 45 minutes? Well, the person, we put somebody in front of you and they were 20 minutes late. So my response was, well, then why don't you make that person wait? This is it's just a small example, but it's something that we see all over the place in every facet of our lives. And so people have allowed that to sort of just permeate their thought process, and it translates and trickles down into everything they do. Well, if this person's going to be this way, then I might as well be this way. Do you ever drive along the road and, you know, somebody's trying to get into the lane, and you know, years ago you always used to let somebody in, and then you watch somebody who just cuts the person off, and you think, like, what is that about? It's that kind of stuff that translates into the workplace, those kinds of small examples that where people just are thinking about themselves and very self-centric, as opposed to thinking about the better, you know, the greater good of the organization. Because if, you know, if the business and the company does well, everybody does well. So that's really where a lot of this came from.
So we're speaking with Julie Camp. She is the author of My Bad to My Best. A great book, and I recommend that certainly everybody goes to Amazon.com, or they can go to the From My Bad to My Best .com and get it as well. Julie, you know, one of the things that you talk about in the book and is this shift to my bad replaces I'm sorry. And you're talking a little bit about this has reached crisis levels. And it's true. Oh, my bad. Sorry about that. You know, or, you know, or not even necessarily saying sorry. You know, where exactly do you think, as you look over this, you know, over this next couple of years as to how this shift even makes it worse, because, you know, that seems to be a millennial phrase. Or does it really, is there a way to shift the culture as it becomes more of a challenge to communicate between organizations and their employees?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that, you know, it really stems down, you know, boils down to accountability, right? You make a mistake and say, my bad is kind of like, no big deal. I'm really sorry. I made a mistake. It won't happen again. Or, geez, I didn't realize it. I mean, there's so many ways that that apology could come through in a way that makes the person who you're dealing with feel like you really cared about the fact that you made a mistake. And people make mistakes. I mean, there's no, you know, that's just a fact of life. But I don't know if it's only a millennial thing. I've experienced it at so many different levels. I think that saying you're sorry for some people is very difficult, and I'm not really sure why. I think it's something we have to go back to basics. I sort of liken it to, you know, when a professional golfer is, you know, on top for, you know, all these numbers of different tournaments, and all of a sudden they can't win a tournament for a couple of years. They have to go back to basics. They have to figure out, is their grip right? Is their stance right? All the things that you do when you're in that realm. But it's the same thing with people. My bad is just, I have found that it's almost like saying, well, I don't really care that I made a mistake. We have to teach and discuss and have conversation about the fact and communicate that caring about your work product and caring about what you produce in an organization and caring about the outcomes of what you're doing is extremely important. And I think that in and of itself, whether you're a millennial, you're a Gen X, you're a baby boomer, I've heard baby boomers say it too. There are just some people who do not want to say, I'm sorry. And I'm sorry doesn't make you a bad person. I'm sorry doesn't make you a lesser person. I'm sorry doesn't mean that you're insignificant. It actually makes you a bigger person, because in organizations, the people who take accountability, in my opinion, are the ones that really have the freedom to kind of move forward and sort of take on big roles in the organization and do great and big things. So So I think it's, you know, we all have a responsibility sort of, you know, once, I call it skunking, where we skunk around, you know, one person at a time. It was like, you know, you tell somebody and they tell somebody and they tell somebody and say, it's okay to make a mistake. It's okay to say you're sorry. That's the way it should be handled, because my bad just kind of feels like, eh, you know, doesn't really matter. And that's the message that I think we all need to get out. You've offended me, I'm sorry. I've offended you, I'm sorry. Whatever the, you know, I made a mistake and I won't, you know, I hope that you can, you know, understand that, you know, whatever it was and why I made the mistake. It's just, and then you've got the situation where, you know, people don't say anything. You know, you could send somebody an email and just say, you know, I haven't heard back from you. It's, I've reached out to you a couple of times. I don't want to be, you know, a pest. And the person just goes, oh, I've been really busy. Like, that's not how we should be treating one another. It's like nobody owes you anything other than just to respond to communication. So I don't know what the future is going to look like. I mean, I imagine that technology is going to continue to grow and to thrive and to become even more pervasive in our lives. I tend to think that that's going to put a lot of stress and strain on personal relationships. It's just something that I think, depending upon how you grow up and what generation you grow up in, you may be more used to things. The millennial generation may be more used to that kind of way, and it may not bother them. But you got, you know, 65 or 70 million people in the workforce, and you've got another 40 million behind that. You've got like 100 million people in the workforce that were probably trained differently. So there's a difference of style, and I think in the year 2020, we're going to see five generations working alongside one another, and that's going to be a real challenge for a lot of organizations. How are you going to get, if you have millennials managing baby boomers, how is that what's that communication going to look like? If you've got, you know, so everybody communicates differently, I think that's where the conundrum is going to come in for organizations as to how they want to communicate with one another. And I think there's some real training that has to get done.
We're talking with Julie Campton. I'm David Chulo, your host of the HR Power Hour. And we're broadcasting on WLOB 100.5 FM. And we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking to an author. That's right, an award-winning author. One of the best authors out there, Julie Kampf. Not bad, right, Julie? My bad to my best. We're talking about her book, and we're talking about really bringing some civility back to the workplace. So in that way, in that conversation, one of the things that we're talking about here is that this not only has an impact to employees, but it can have an impact on customers. And it says in the stats here that 15% of incivility target purpose decreases customer service. Well, you talk about 10 ways to fight by restoring simple dignities in the workplace. What are those 10 things?
Well, I think, first of all, being a good listener is extremely important. I think you need to understand what the ask is before you make sure that you start responding to people. I think that really knowing and seeking to understand. You know, a lot of times people feel like they know something before they actually really know it. So I would say that being a really good listener is very important. I think that being civil, right? I mean, I think, walking your talk, making sure that you are doing what you say that you're going to do. I think being a person of your word and following through, creating trust is really important. Making sure that people can really trust you and that they know that you have their back and you're not somebody who tries to, you know, put them, throw them under the bus. I think that's really important. How about, you know, answering correspondence? making sure that you are, you know, answering people's emails and outreach, making sure that, you know, you are timely in your responses. You know, trying to help people, you know, doesn't make you a smaller person, right? So, I mean, I think, you know, also being accountable and making sure that you're taking responsibility for what you want to do. Helping people to be their best is a place where when you know, companies have everybody being their best, the company is at their best. So, I mean, these are just a number of them. There's so many that actually, you know, are what I call common sense, but not really commonplace. I mean, I think it's important to have the right people in your organization that are going to deliver excellent service, making sure that, you know, you've got a human touch in your organization. You know, it's also making sure that you're investing in training in your companies and people take pride in their workmanship. You know, saying I'm sorry if you make a mistake, it's okay. But these are just some of the things that I think are really important as people, because in the end, I think it is all about people. Herb Kelleher, who was the co-founder and former CEO of Southwest Airlines, said, core of our success, and that's the most difficult thing for a competitor to imitate, is people can buy all the physical things, but the things that you can't buy are dedication, devotion, loyalty, and those feelings that you are participating in sort of a crusade. And I think that that's really important. If you can bring people along in your organization that way, I think you've got, and you set some of the parameters up front, you've got an organization where you create tremendous culture.
We are talking about culture, and I think that, you know, one of the things, and you mentioned in your book, is about the culture shift that's happened in terms of what is expected by people. And social media, as well as just movies and television, all those things have really glamified a lot of celebrities that maybe don't all the time present themselves in the best way, right? And so they create a aura of this, if you want to call it, you know, imagery and that, hey, if you are disrespectful, if you are, you know, you say whatever comes to your mind, it's okay, it's cool. And that really can hurt, especially in the fact that in a business environment, that's not going to get you very far.
David, a lot of this comes down to common sense. I think people have to use their own good judgment to figure out what's right and what's not right. I mean, with no offense to some of the celebrities, how they've gotten to where they are is not something that I would even teach my children or expect to have any kind of relevance in the workplace whatsoever. I think that we have allowed that to happen in our society, but I think we have to make very clear what we're willing to tolerate and what we're willing to accept in the workplace. And, you know, kind of like my dad always told me when I was, you know, dating, he always said, whoever takes the garbage out the first night of the marriage takes it out the rest of the marriage. Well, you know, if we allow that kind of behavior once, we will allow that behavior twice and three times, and it will become part of our culture. I think, you know, working across in my business life, working across 50 different clients, every one of them has created a different culture. You need to decide as a leader what you want your culture to look like and what you want. And there are companies out there that have some of this mentality where they don't really care what people say. You have to decide as either a business owner or a leader what you want that culture to look like, and you set the standards from day one when people come in the door, and then you'll get out of it what you put into it. And I'm a big believer of that.
You talked about Southwest and so forth. You know, just in general, just in your opinion, why is culture so important?
Culture is what leads you to innovate great things. I mean, I spent 17 years, 18 years in the corporate world before I went into my own business. And, you know, every day would go to work, you know, and everybody else, you know, knew what was, you know, there was always a tension and there was always a fear. People at the top knew what was going on, but maybe in middle management or the, you know, more entry-level people didn't really know. And I think when people feel fear, they don't do their best work. I think you motivate people to do their best work when you create a culture where people can be free to, as I said before, to innovate, to bring ideas to the table. They may not always be the right ideas, but if you look at some of the great TED Talks and you look at some of the great things on YouTube in terms of business culture and some of the companies today that are really inspirational and how they set their companies up and how they innovated. Some of the greatest companies in the world that have terrific, cultures. And so I mentioned Zappos in my book as well, because Zappos was a company that we wanted to do business with. And when we reached out to them, we got an answer from them in less than 24 hours thanking them for our response and saying they get 2,000 inquiries a day and we answer every single person. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that is memorable. So wouldn't you rather do business with a company who treats you that way than somebody who just ignores your email? So it's the culture that the CEO and his leadership team or her leadership team has created, and that trickles and cascades down all through the organization. And people are just nicer and more friendly. Doesn't mean that they're less effective. It means that they just create a culture where other people would like to join. And as we think about the talent landscape going forward and the shortage of talent that we're going to have, if you're not setting yourself up as an employer of choice, you're going to have a problem.
You know, you talk about culture, and of course, it's very important. You know, but there are a million different ways that we've heard, not only on this show, but I'm sure across the platform, in terms of hearing, hey, if you do this, your culture will improve. If you do this, you'll have a better culture. If you do that, hey, culture will come along. You know, it sounds so simple. However, is it?
I think it is simple to create a culture when you kind of start from scratch. I think it's harder when you have a ready-made culture that you already have a certain way that you define what your culture is. So I'll give you an example. There are companies that are so collaborative where consensus is so important across every person in a certain level of the organization that it's very hard to get things done. There are other cultures where I would call it a rough-and-tumble environment where, you know, the people at the top in leadership don't really care how people are spoken to, but they get done what they need to get done. There's all types of different cultures that get created. What you see sometimes is when a CEO steps down or retires or whatever, and a new CEO walks in and sits with his or her leadership team and says, this is the kind of culture I want to create. Here's what we're doing from day one of my, you know, leadership. I think it's easier. I think it also depends on the size of the organization. I think most people would rather work for a company that's a more collegial, collaborative environment where people are nice to one another. You know, nice doesn't mean, and I say it again, that you're not effective. You can be the nicest person in the world. I believe that the CEO of Blackstone said, I'd rather hire somebody who's nice than somebody who's got an MBA, because it's important that we have a nice culture. I think it can be shifted. I think it's not going to change overnight. But I think there are people, and I've seen consultants who go into companies and they help with customer service and they help with, you know, client centricity, and it does work. And I wouldn't say anything good is easy, but it certainly is important.
No, I guess I agree in the sense that, you know, look, there are many ways to shift culture, but sometimes, as to your point, it's much harder to change the culture once it's been set, right, to be in place. Mm-hmm. So as you think about that for a few seconds in terms of your book and the way you think about how important culture is, do you have some, what we'd say, some simple ways for someone who's in HR who's trying to change the culture, or a business owner who's trying to change the culture in their environment? What are like two or three things that you say, okay, these are absolute musts to make it for you to be able to actually change a culture within your organization?
It's a great question. I think one of the things that's really important is you cannot allow toxicity in the organization. I mean, there are people that come into organizations that are toxic, and I think we have to keep a really strong watch out for those kinds of people and how, you know, insidiously they go behind and start to have conversations with other people about other things in the organization that ultimately people start to, it becomes a feeder pool, right? And it's just, you know, they just start to have these negative conversations where, you know, once you get those toxic people out of the environment, people can sort of breathe again. And I've seen that happen time and time and time again. I think the other thing for me, I just think follow-up. You know, my follow-up has follow-up. So at the end of the day, for the most part, and things do fall through the cracks every now and then, but I would say that, you know, responsive time. If someone in HR says, look, we've created a culture here by which everybody answers one another within 24 hours with no fail, unless, you know, God forbid something happens to you, I think what that does is it creates a respect. And I think it's, you know, I know respect is earned, but I think just, you know, people in most organizations don't do that. So I think if you just train your people in your organization to say, hey, everybody's communication is important, so make sure that within 24 hours, that's our policy. And I think, I think that create a little fun in the organization. I mean, we celebrate birthdays, we celebrate, you know, upcoming weddings, we celebrate engagements, we celebrate all kinds of things here. We have, you know, we decorate pumpkins and then we donate them to a children's hospital. I mean, maybe it sounds like you don't have time to do that. It doesn't take a lot of time, but, you know, it also gives people a chance to kind of breathe and have fun with one another. We do, you know, two or three times a year we do an outing together where we go play miniature golf or we go bowling or we have pizza lunch. And it sounds like romper room, but it's not. It's a way to really thank people that, hey, we know you're working hard, and here's some fun on top of it. You don't only need to have fun off hours. Those are good ways to kind of create culture. So it's respect. It's making sure that there's no, you know, the toxic people are sort of managed out of the organization, and having fun with one another and really getting comfortable with each other as a sort of secondary family.
Some organizations are more family than others. Certainly when you're talking about family-owned businesses or something to that effect, you really do have a family environment that is core necessarily to the organization. And then, of course, you have organizations that are maybe there's no family involved. It's just a bunch of people or people that have come together to make that happen. When you're talking about a family-owned business where you have this nucleus of the family really either controlling or potentially, you know, operating in terms of the way, how do you make sure that family dynamic, that piece of it, right, that solid equation that has to be there for the business to succeed, how do you make sure that culture is okay for the people around that family nucleus?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I actually worked for a family business once. I think a lot of people are not very aware of what that dynamic looks like. You know, you have to hire people outside your family unless you're less like, you know, used to be the King family where you had, you know, endless numbers of people that could come to work for you. People need to understand, what does the long term look like for me? And you need to know going into that, if it's a family business, you know, what does that look like? Is the family succession plan going to be, you know, there's scads and scads of people, so I'm never going to really make it to the top, or I'm never going to really have a stake in this business, and you need to have your eyes open to that. There are other situations. I mean, I'm the sole owner of my business, but I don't have anybody from my family who's going to come into this business, so I've made the people here my family. But family businesses are definitely, they have a different nuance and a sort of a different dynamic to them, and it's about sort of keeping your eyes open and making sure that everything you've been promised when you walk in the door actually can be realized. And sometimes that gets done by due diligence before you walk in the door and seeing, like, you know, so what has it looked like? Well, this has been a family business for, you know, four generations. Well, probably I'm never going to get to be the CEO of this company, or I'm not going to get to be this. But if you're okay with that and you like what you do, and let's say you're a chief marketing officer and you're good with, you know, doing marketing for a family-owned business, then that's great. It's all around how you set up your own expectations.
We're talking with Julie Camp. She is the author of From My Bad to My Best, How Individuals and Companies Can Differentiate Themselves in the Age of Mediocrity. And I'm your host, David Chulo, and you're listening to WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB and presented by CMAcareer.com. and main.dalecarnegie.com. I'm your host, David Chulo, and today we're having a great conversation with Julie Camp. Her book, My Bad to My Best, we're having some great discussions on this. And I got to tell you, civility Back in the workplace. What a concept, Julie. What a concept.
Oh, I hope from your mouth to God, dear.
Well, we'll see what happens, right? We'll see what happens. You know, one of the things that you talk about in your book, and I think is important, is you talk about differentiation. So what does it actually mean, differentiation?
Well, I think people probably have their own, you know, definitions of what that means, but it's no different in a sense when you go to price a car and you go from one dealer to the next, and if you're the kind of person that thinks about customer service and it's not just about price, you know, for within a, you know, a small variation of price, they're all going to be about the same. But who's got a great reputation? Who follows through when you've got a problem with your car? Who's the person that you can count on if your car gets stuck and you need a tow and you can call them on the phone? That's part of what differentiation is in any facet of every field in every profession. And I think that making sure that you do enough to show your customers or your employees or your whatever your audience is how you differentiate yourself and how you set yourself apart from the rest of the competition, because we all have competition. In my line of work, you know, I compete against firms that are doing significant amounts of business that are publicly held companies, and yet I still manage to differentiate myself because some of the things that I've done may be different or more desired than some of the things that they've done for that particular client. It doesn't mean it's right for everybody. So I think when you're thinking about what do I do differently? How do I set myself apart? How do I stand out in a crowd? You know, why is it that one musician is more successful than another who may, you know, be very talented? And those are the ways that you really need to think in terms of, you know, in today's landscape where because of social media, there is so much more competition that you know about. It doesn't mean that there's more competition than there was before. It just means that you know more about it because it's more available in the public domain. So if you're a company that's looking to hire folks and you want to make sure that you've got the best talent, well, what is it about your organization that makes you different from other companies in your area of expertise and maybe not even in your area of expertise? If you want to hire a CFO, let's say, you know, what makes ABC company better than EDF company? And that's what we talk about in terms of differentiation, and there's a reason that we talk about it, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier on the show, was, you know, there is a real talent shortage that's headed, and people are not talking about it so much, they're not thinking about it so much. There is a real significant talent shortage that is going to happen, and as long as you continue to make yourself just be like everybody else and not stand out from the crowd, what is the probability that you're going to get the opportunity to hire the best talent because they want to come and work for you because they've heard, oh, you have a great company? Look at things like Glassdoor, for example, or if you go, you know, if you go to look at the rating of a physician and people give their reviews. I mean, there's reviews on everything today, restaurants, name it. So if you're not working hard to make sure that your reputation in the market is not stellar and different from your competitor, how do people differentiate you? And that's really what it's all about.
Is there really a difference between individual differentiation and company differentiation, or is it kind of blended?
What I would say to that question is, it depends. And the reason I say that is because if you were to come and talk to the folks in my company, and we've had this done before where people are, you know, contemplating coming to work with our organization, they might talk to everyone in the company and they'll say, wow, everybody's sort of rowing in the same direction. And that is the best thing as a business owner or a leader that you could ever hear. In other companies, and we do this as a matter of practice, we go into organizations and we'll talk to the senior management team, and oftentimes you'll get very different viewpoints about certain things and policies in the organization, and that's where you start to get a little bit of, and it's okay for people to have different points of view because that's a good thing. It just depends on how it manifests itself. So if the company is a highly collaborative, as I mentioned before, you know, really tight-knit, collegial, but driving consensus is tough, and then if you have somebody who's a real consensus driver and knows how to get to the answer faster, then that person may differentiate themselves. You see what I'm saying? So if you're, it just depends on how much you need to step outside of your comfort level based upon the culture of an organization. And that's why I only say it depends. In certain companies, everybody sort of and I say this in a very positive way because I think it's a good thing, drinks the Kool-Aid, which means that the message is clear, the brand is clear, the path is clear, the expectations are clear. That's all really good stuff. Sometimes you get into companies where people are like, the head of the organization and maybe the leadership team is just, you know, saying one thing, but in order to get your job done, you need to do something else, and you need to have to figure out how to get that done without ruffling too many feathers. You can differentiate yourself when it's not just the organization that's differentiating themselves. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Well, I think to one sense, from an individual standpoint, you're building your own brand no matter what, even if you're within a large organization or not. And just simple things such as responding to your own emails that come in and making sure that you're taking care of the people that are sending them, either internal or external clients, or you're making sure you're responding. Maybe it's not necessarily the full culture of the organization, but you can really stand out and shine within that organization if you make that individual effort to make that happen.
Sure. That's exactly what I'm saying. And I think one of the ways that we have differentiated ourselves over the years is because we are so client-centric. And whereas companies might wait for a couple of days to respond or whatever, I mean, we are so fast to respond that we've almost trained, and I say it in the most in the nicest way, but we've trained our clients to expect that they will get a response within an incredibly short period of time. And that's how we want it to be, because we want them to know that their business is very important to us, that it's not, I'll get to it when I get to it. No, when that email comes in, that email is responded to, and that issue is taken care of, or that whatever topic it is. And so it is easy, actually, to really differentiate yourself. And I'm going to be honest and put a stake in the ground and say, David, we live in a world of mediocrity. And so at the end of the day, it's not that difficult to differentiate yourself if you're doing things and you're on top of stuff. And that's how it has worked out really well. I mean, we've built our business over the past 14 years, and you know, it's really important to me and to everybody in this organization that we treat the client with the utmost of rapid response and urgency. And that can really help you stand out.
No, there's no question it can. And, you know, one of the other things that I know we get asked about in terms of when somebody is trying to build their brand or trying to be someone who is really responsive to the customer or to the client or whatever they're doing, is the fact it takes the right attitude. It's that personal inner attitude that people have. And you can really see it in organizations that are firing on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. You know, are there things that you see or things that you would say to an organization who's not only trying to change the culture but also trying to fire up the inner belly of their team?
Right. Well, I think part of a leader's responsibility is to ignite their organization. So you bring up a great point. I mean, there's, you know, always three things that I think a great leader does. One is be extremely curious and ask a lot of questions, because you can't have all the answers. Second is to be a visionary and to really kind of get a sense for what does the organization look like down the road and where do we see the opportunities. And the third thing, and they're all important and they're all on the same level in terms of importance, is how do you ignite your team consistently. And I think that by example and by giving responsibility to people, rewarding them, acknowledging them for a job well done, even for the smallest things, being thoughtful and responsible and respectful, you can ignite that in somebody. And I think people feel that. And when they feel that, they feel that they want to do a good job because they're part of something. It's the bigger landscape.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that you put here towards the end of your book, you talk about you should always shoot for the moon and hope to get the roof, because if you shoot for the roof, you may only get to the cellar.
Well, Joan Rivers was the person that I first heard say that, and I thought that was, there were two sayings that have stayed with me in my life, and that's one of them. She always would say, you got to shoot for the moon because you may only get the roof. What that means is, you know, you put yourself out there and you shoot for the top that you possibly can, because if you only shoot for the middle, you're probably just going to get the basement. And I always feel like it's okay to not succeed as long as you made your best effort and you put that out there. And then the other saying that I thought was really important in my life, that I worked for a gentleman who was terrific and the CEO of the company, who always said, nothing good is easy and nothing easy is important. And those are the two things that I sort of just live my life by, is just always shooting for the moon. And it's okay if I only get, you know, the roof, but just making sure that I know when I start to feel frustrated or I feel like things aren't going the way I'd like them to go, hey, you know, if it was so easy, it wouldn't be important. And that's what I've tried to instill in the people that work with me here. And in, you hear I say work with me. Everybody absolutely works for me, but that's not the kind of environment that I've created. When you can create that kind of environment where people feel really valued and important and they feel like they're a team as opposed to a hierarchy, I think there's a lot of good that comes out of that.
You're absolutely right. And we're talking with Julie Camp, author from My Bad to My Best. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB. And we will be right back.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we've been talking with Julie Camp and her book. That's right, the book that we think you should go right now to Amazon and buy, or go to from bad to my best.com. It is her book, From My Bad to My Best. And we're talking with Julie Camp today. You know, I'm your host, David Chulo, and we've had a great hour of the HR Power Hour here. And so as we end this show in the next few minutes, I thought I'd ask Julie a question having to do really with, as she's in the talent field, what's going on and what she's seeing with talent today. Julie, what are you seeing with the talent market today?
Well, David, as I kind of mentioned earlier in the program, without getting too detailed, I mean, we've got a tremendous generational shift never seen before in the workforce. We've got about 74 million baby boomers that are, you know, retiring at, you know, unprecedented paces. I mean, people said with the financial crisis, people wouldn't retire. Well, they are retiring. There's just so much runway that anybody has in terms of age. So then you've got a generation behind that, which most people would call the Gen Xers, which you've got about 44 million or so in that generation, one of the smallest generations we've ever seen. And that is the generation that will be taking over the leadership. If you figure that the average age of a CEO in the C-suite is somewhere in the mid-50s, so now you're talking about folks in their, you know, late 30s, early 40s, and some of those people may or may not have the intellectual horsepower yet. Some of that leadership comes with, you know, time and maturity. And then you've got the 80 million, you know, millennials that come behind that, who work differently, think differently, really in terms of wanting purpose. I think they always used to say that the baby boomer generation used to live to work. I think they say the millennials work to live. There's a very different mindset as to how that all takes place. So as I mentioned, in the year 2020, they're saying that there's potentially, you know, 4 to 5 generations working alongside one another in the corporate world. So that's going to be a real challenge. And that's why this book is so important, because I do believe that differentiation and how you differentiate yourself as a company, make yourself an employer of choice, those are really important factors as to how you are able to attract great talent to your organization.
Well, you know, as we talk about talent, one of the things that we think about is the shift that millennials now are over 50% of the workforce. As we have about a minute left before we get into the wrap-up, tell me what you think that means in terms of how the shift is happening from a cultural standpoint.
Yeah, I see it in my own organization. I mean, you know, they like to work differently, sometimes more remotely, sometimes with different types of flexibility. We've created an environment where, you know, people can work at home on a Friday when they can, or we've created an environment where, you know, being remote in terms of technology is important. I think the millennial generation has a lot to share. I think that I tremendously value the millennial generation. I think they are more technologically savvy. They know things and they see things differently. They've created a greater purpose for our organization because it's really important to them, you know, why they do what they do. So I think that's really important that companies know exactly why they do what they do, not what they do. So a lot of that comes from the millennial generation, and I think it's a terrific balance for those of us that have had no work-life balance in their lives, to really take a look at that and say, how do we still achieve what we want for success in this company, but do it in a way that may be different? And change is, you know, could be scary for some people. I think change is very important. If you stay the same, you're not getting any better. So I think the millennial generation has really helped us look at it differently.
So, Julie, as we wrap up, 1 minute to go, tell me what the couple of tips you would make sure that people took away from today's show.
Well, I think one really important tip is, you know, you can't confuse being tough or firm with being nice and getting results. I think that it's, you know, we're not looking to create, as I mentioned before, this isn't Disneyland, unless you work for Disney, but we're not looking for the kind of environment that says, okay, you made a mistake, no problem, it's okay if you do it again. That's not what I'm saying. I think the takeaway is create an environment where you want to come to work every day, feel valued, feel like you can give your ideas, where everyone at the table can present their thoughts and ideas so that they can feel valued. So you can't really confuse that sort of niceness and firmness at the same time. It's okay. I think treat other people how you would like to be treated, and if you don't really like to be treated that way, think about what is the best way that we can treat our customers, our employees, our everybody that works for an organization, and you really need to think about what you want your culture to stand for. And I think if you can walk away thinking that, you know, nice really does matter, I think the whole world should really become a nicer place, especially the U.S. I think people in the United States are looking for, you know, people to be nicer, be more respectful, and I think that's across everything that we do today. Be respectful if you're a physician of people's time. Be respectful if you own a cruise line and your people get stuck out in the middle of the ocean with very little running water. Be respectful of people and just think about how you want to set up your life. And the last thing I would just say is, you know, my dad always said when you're 60 or in your 60s or later on in life, you want to be able to look in the mirror and know what kind of person you were, because those are the memories that you create for yourself. And so that's how I live my life every single day, and it has really fared very well for me.
We've had a great show today talking with Julie Kampf. She's the author of From My Bad to My Best. You're listening to the HR Power Hour. And, Julie, I want to thank you for being on the show today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope you've enjoyed our time together.
Absolutely. And again, remember, you can go to frommybadtomybest.com and order Julie's book. And, of course, you can go to hrpowerhour.com right after the show, and you can connect with Julie directly. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
This is Tawny Alvarez with Veral Dana. Last week, we began with a few tips on how to appropriately respond to an OSHA audit. This week, we will provide you with a few more. After verifying the identity of the inspector, ensure the individual inspector is wearing appropriate safety gear for your establishment during the course of the audit. Next, make sure that records that may be needed by the inspector are easily accessible. Best practices as far as document retention can come in handy during any audit, whether Department of Transportation, Department of Labor, or OSHA. Next, make sure the inspector is comfortable, but not too comfortable. Provide him or her with a room or area to perform the audit and interview employees if necessary. Finally, correct hazards that are pointed out by the inspector. You do not have to wait until an official citation to correct hazards is issued. Correcting hazards not formally cited does not imply guilt, but instead enhances employee safety. For more information, contact a member of Veral Dana's Labor and Employment Practice Group to discuss more.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m., or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.